Zen Master Hakuin's chant in praise of Zazen. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. Like water and ice without water, no ice outside us, no Buddhas. How near the truth, yet how far we seek. Like one in water crying, I thirst. Like a child of rich birth, wandering poor in this earth, we endlessly circle the six worlds. The cause of our sorrow is ego delusion. From dark path to dark path, we've wandered in darkness. How can we be free from birth and death? The gateway to freedom is Zazen Samadhi. Beyond exaltation, beyond all our praises, the pure Mahayana. Upholding the precepts, repentance, and giving, the countless good deeds in the way of right living all come from Zazen. Thus, one true Samadhi extinguishes evils. It purifies karma, dissolving obstructions. Then where are the dark paths to lead us astray? The pure lotus land is not far away. Hearing this truth, heart humble and grateful, to praise and embrace it, to practice its wisdom, brings unending blessings, brings mountains of merit. And when we turn inward and prove our true nature, that true self is no self, our own self is no self, we go beyond ego and past clever words. Then the gate to the oneness of cause and effect is thrown open. Not two and not three, straight ahead runs the way. Our form, no being, no form, we never leave home. Our thought, now being no thought, our dancing and songs are the voice of the Dharma. How vast is the heaven of boundless samadhi. How bright and transparent the moonlight of wisdom. What is there outside us? What is there we lack? Nirvana is openly shown to our eyes. This earth where we stand is the pure lotus land. And this very body, the body of Buddha. Today I'd like to talk about what we just chanted. And actually, I want to talk about the real Buddhism, what it means, what it does, and most importantly, what we do to become, let's put it, relatively selfless individuals dedicated ultimately to serving all beings. Basically, the concentration of Zen needs to lead us to freedom from the lust for results and freedom from the morbid fear of failure. And the best example of this mind state, if available to ordinary, to most people, is the performance that many athletes, athletic performance. And I'm going to talk about a few instances of extraordinary athletic performance and the mind state behind these instances. And then I'm going to read a section of Roshi Kaplow's Three Pillars of Zen, which really demonstrates what the teacher's role is, how she or he is trying to help people achieve this, let's call it, Buddhist mind state. So one thing is the Olympics having come up lately that has a bunch of really good examples. And before that, there was the Super Bowl, which I understand very few people under 50 are interested in football anymore, and mostly it's computer stuff. But anyway, the Super Bowl had an extraordinary success this year, in that the quarterback of the Philadelphia Eagles, who had been relegated to a second-string quarterback for a number of years, demonstrated the mind state we're talking about, this concentrated, relatively selfless mind state. Nick said, I felt calm. The big thing for me was knowing that I didn't have to be Superman. I was just playing ball. Some other things that this Nick Foles said. I guess he intends to be a Christian leader, minister, or whatever, after he leaves football. But he has some very interesting observations. There's quite a bit to this guy. He says failure is a part of life. It's a part of building character and growing. Without failure, who would you be? And I conjecture that maybe not so many of us would be here without some level of failure in the past. So Nick says, I wouldn't be up here if I hadn't fallen thousands of times, made mistakes. We are all human, we all have weaknesses, and I think, though it's important to be able to share that and be transparent. I know when I listen to people speak and they share their weaknesses, I'm listening because it resonates. So I'm not perfect. I'm not Superman. I might be in the NFL. I may have just won a Super Bowl. But hey, we still have daily struggles. I still have daily struggles. And that's where my faith comes in. That's where my family comes in. I think when you look at struggles in your life, just know that it's an opportunity for your character to grow. Simple. If something's going on in your life and you're struggling, embrace it because you're growing. In another instance, a young fellow named Red Gerard, American, snowboarder, won his event, the slopestyle competition, in the third run. After two seriously failed runs, it was his third run, and he was 11th in the standings. And he said, after coming all this way, I just wanted to get a good run. And he did an absolutely stunning, stunning run and won the event. But see, his you can feel his attitude. It was free of the lust for results and free from the morbid fear of failure. And another instance, kind of very interesting to me, a woman named Esther Ledecka, it comes from not Czechoslovakia, from the Bohemia, the Czech part, not the Slovak part. And she, as it says here, she stepped out of her snowboarding long enough to click onto her skis and became an Olympic gold medalist. This 22-year-old from the Czech Republic who dabbles in both realms couldn't quite believe it. Ledecka made a stunning run from back in the pack to take the Super G title on Saturday at the Pyeongchang Games. Till today I thought I'm a better snowboarder, she said. The 26th racer to take the course, she was at the very end, and someone else thought that she had already won. Anna Faith of Austria thought she had already won, but Ledecka just squeezed in and did the last run. And she shredded her way through in a time of of 21.11 seconds, the defending champion Anna Wies of Austria earned the silver, finishing 1/100th of a second back. 1/100th of a second in around 60 miles an hour, which the Super G is 60, 65 miles an hour. It's about 7 or 8 inches. She says, "I was probably the only snowboarder on site. All the other girls didn't risk a lot. There must be a lot of pressure on them. I was just trying to do my best run." Ledecka's run shocked even her. She thought to herself, it's probably some kind of a mistake, when she looked up at the board and saw that she had won by 1/100th of a second. And she was sure that they were going to change it back in a few seconds, that correct what was up on the board. And shortly after finishing, she knew she had won. She says, how did that happen? In the newspaper, I got this, where the editor put these words, wonderful question. And then her coach said about her, if you give her the most mundane task, she won't step away from it until she's mastered it. She actually wore her goggles to the post-race press conference because, quote, I wasn't prepared to be at the ceremony and I don't have any makeup on. Samadhi concentration is to the point of self-forgetfulness. This is what Zen training is about. If we just a little note what samadhi means, and in terms of physical thing, is that you can see on the faces of the people in samadhi this calm radiance. We have two new figures in Rochester. Maybe some of you haven't seen them. Sudama obtained them in Vietnam. On those faces, there is this beautiful, calm radiance. This one's a little more difficult, the one in the Zendo here. It's there, but it's much more obvious on the new one that we have, the Burmese one that we have going down the front stairs into the exercise room. If you look at that face, it's all there. And then one more figure that we have that Roshi and Amala bought in Toronto, must be 10 years ago or longer now, piano room. And that is a very small figure, but if you look at that face, you also see this calm radiance, which is samadhi. That's what we're all working for here when we do zazen. But in Zen training, we need, actually, as in sports, we need some kind of pressure. Maybe you're getting old and your years are, you're looking forward to less years on the planet. And that can be a pressure. And I think you could say that it's the teacher's job to provide the right amount of pressure for each student. Without this pressure, there's just sitting, but there's no concentration to the point of self-forgetfulness. Concentration needs a little pressure, as it happens in sports. That's why these people achieve this mind state, because there's the pressure. And another part of the price of success is leaving behind many failures, letting go of failure. Now I'm going to read something which I surmise that many or most of us have read, but maybe many years ago. And it's in Roshi Kaplow's book. It's one of the things in a chapter entitled Enlightenment Experiences. And this little chapter tells you a lot. And the idea I'm presenting this so that people understand and accept and even welcome the right amount of pressure. This is number 7 on page 250, and it's Mrs. LTS, an American artist, age 51. This happens to this Sashin, Yasutani Roshi Sashin, who happened to be held at Pendle Hill, a Quaker study center in Wallingford, Pennsylvania, where I happened to be the year later. So that's where my copy of Roshi's book comes from. I had come to Zen and the Pendle Hill, Pennsylvania Sashin obliquely and inevitably. As I look back over my shoulder at the apparent meandering of my path to the moment of realization, I see that it led straight to the sound of that tiny, it's written here, Kinhin bell, but I think it should be Inking bell. As a sculptor, as a wife and mother, as a drunk, and finally as a member of Alcohol Anonymous, I had good pre-training. Am I talking loud enough? Okay, good. I suppose the first step in this life was the knowing at about 15 that I must be an artist. This knowing coincided with a total rejection of Christianity, as I saw it, and an earnest groping for truth within myself. In a few years, I discovered stone, and I again knew that carving was my way, slow and hard, as the inner groping was also slow and hard. I was determined to experience as much as possible, so marriage and family followed. But in time, my zest for living became throttled. Life was too much for me, and it began to pinch and bruise. Then I discovered blessed alcohol, which subtly dulled my pain and unshackled my soaring spirit. Stone rested silently, untouched. My husband and children, demanding my love, were pushed aside. No sculpture, no wholehearted acceptance of my family, just pain and guilt and inadequacy. And slowly alcohol took over and controlled my life. I no longer knew my center. Life was a bad dream. Struggling from one 24 hours to the next, I was controlled by fear and guilt and the secret bottle. I would not believe that I could not find a way out. So 8 years of psychiatry and attempts at every method of self-discipline I knew of followed. But I was still trapped. One morning, which seemed no different from all other terrible mornings, I phoned Alcoholics Anonymous for help. With this act, I was at last freed to truly look at myself, and with the help of all other alcoholics who had lived through the same hell, to be myself. I stopped drinking. I learned that there is something infinitely more powerful than my small human mind. And I knew that I must find it, know it, see it, and be it. My search had begun. A few weeks later, idly looking at books on a bargain counter, I picked up How to Know God, a translation by Swami Prabhavananda and Christopher Isherwood of Patanjali's aphorisms. I was stunned. Patanjali had known and taught, perhaps 2,000 years ago, what I had just discovered for myself. This book I read and reread and studied and puzzled over for 2 months on the deck of our schooner as we sailed up the Atlantic coast and down again on a vacation trip. All footnote material was tracked down, books ordered, and devoured. The deep need for a teacher was answered by my finding Swami Pramananda, who agreed to help me. He guided and directed me, started me in disciplined meditation, helped me sort out hallucinations from reality, prepared me for the great plunging effort at Pendle Hill. In the course of my reading, I had found references to Zen in Huxley's Perennial Philosophy. This I knew was for me. I continued to read, to practice Kriya meditation, though not to sit in the Zen way. Entirely unexpectedly, I was given an opportunity to go to Japan for a few months to supervise the construction of an exhibit I had designed. There I ruthlessly, persistently chased Zen, and when I was shown, as ruthlessly, that the only place to chase it was within myself, I was told to sit. I sat at Sesshin in Engakuji, Yutakuji, and briefly at Nanzenji. I also sat at Ryosen-an in Daitokuji. It happened this way. Before leaving America, I had heard of Engakuji, so I went there. When I arrived on a cold November train, I had no idea what to do, no introduction to anyone, no understanding of Japanese. Not knowing which way to turn, I stood irresolute alone in a gray, deserted landscape with rain soaking through my raincoat, running down my neck, dripping into my shoes. A dark figure ran out in the rain. Helplessly, we looked at each other. Words tumbled out, Japanese and English. He beckoned me to follow and led me to a door where he knocked and called. A figure appeared. It was a young English woman who, after a brisk conversation in Japanese with my guide, asked what she could do for me. She took me to the head monk and arranged for me to stay. They were in Sesshin. Taught me how to get through the meals, requested an interview with the Roshi, and interpreted for me. She was my guide and good friend. Her final gift was to introduce me to an American Zen student who arranged by telephone for me to go to Rutakuji for more sitting. So it went on and on, kindness from so many people and painful, painful sitting. Wherever I sought help in Japan, from a Roshi, a monk, or a lay student, I found it. The compassion of all these people for my floundering ignorance has been infinite, and I am so grateful. The ting of that tiny bell at Pendle Hill Sesshin was the shock, the force that crumbled walls that had been gently eroding through 4 years of Zazen, and before that 5 years of Kriya Yoga every day, every night. Patiently, stubbornly, I had sat. Sometimes a long time, sometimes a few minutes, but always, every day. Sitting patiently had become so familiar that I accepted it as naturally and uneventfully as breathing. When I arrived at the Pendle Hill Sesshin, I had never seen Yasutani Roshi before. For those of you who might not know, Yasutani Roshi was Roshi Kaplow's last teacher. There was we won't go to that. His monk interpreter I had met at Rutakuji, where I had attended a Sesshin 4 years earlier. I was braced for the physical misery of 4.5 days of Zazen, but I also knew well that the reward was clarity and peace. After attending the Sesshin in Delaware conducted by Nakagawa Roshi in 1961, I had jotted down quote, I feel I've been turned inside out, shaken, and rinsed in pure, clear water. So this Pendle Hill Sesshin began. About 40 strangers sat together, some merely curious, some very earnest. Yasutani Roshi divided the group according to their express purpose for being there into several smaller groups. Notice this point, I want to say. The fact that he divided this group, he's not going to deal with all these people in the same way. Some may get great pressure, some may be given simple instruction to get them going. Anyway, so he divided these groups into several smaller groups. He spoke privately to each of the groups, explaining the discipline they were to follow during the next 4.5 days. I was one of those who sought enlightenment, and to this group he gave the koan Joshu's Mu. I began to sit with Mu. The first day, Mu was no hot iron ball. In fact, it was a heavy lump of lead in my belly. Melt that lead, the Roshi commanded. But it would not melt, so next day I hammered with Mu and came to know that its center was a brilliant, crystalline light, like a star or diamond, so brilliant that it outlined and illumined physical objects, dazzled my eyes, filled me with light. My body felt weightless, I thought. This is Mu. But the Roshi counseled, hallucinations. Ignore them. Concentrate harder. By the end of that day, there was no light, just drowsiness, infinite weariness, and Mu. Before going to bed, I wrote a note to myself. Now I am determined, period. If others can do it, I can too. And I will. I will exhaust every bit of strength and stubborn determination. Then I slept, with Mu blanketing dreams, Mu moving in and out with each breath. The third day, my eyes would not stay open. With each breath, they closed. When I fought this off, my mind was immediately filled with problems of my family and marriage. It was a terrible struggle against both sleep and mental torment. With each breath, I was determined to get hold of Mu, but it went down and down and disappeared in nothingness. Go deeper, said the Roshi. Question, what is this Mu? To the very bottom. Deeper and deeper I went. My hold was torn loose and I went spinning to the center of the world, to the center of the cosmos, to the center. I was there. With the sound of the little inking bell, I suddenly knew. Too late to see the Roshi that night, I rushed to the first doksan in the morning. Questions, sharp voices, laughter, movement. The Roshi said, now you understand that seeing Mu is seeing God. Let me pronounce that better. Now you understand that seeing Mu is seeing God. I understood. After a miscellaneous koan zazen at Brewster, New York, several weeks later, she writes, I feel clean, I feel free, I feel free to live every, I feel ready to live every day with zest by choice. I am delighted by the adventure of each moment. I feel as though I have just awakened from a restless, disjointed dream. Everything looks different. The world no longer rides heavily on my back. It is under my belt. I turned a somersault and somehow swallowed it. I am no longer restless. At last I have what I want. Obviously, that's a pretty deep enlightenment experience that she had, but it doesn't mean that she's finished. And I take it that she did go on. I happen to have worked in that very building where they had this sesshin. A year later, I was cleaning and redoing some floors and that. So it was really interesting to me to hear about this account. I want to tell you about another account, another enlightenment thing that I came in contact with another person. I won't give his real name because he might really be around sometime, and I'll call him John. He worked with Errol for many years in her physical therapy department, and he came here to Pendle Hill, and he came saying, I came on this trip to make amends. He had he explained he had been in an incredibly deep period of depression, some weeks or months, I can't remember just how long, where he was hospitalized for his depression. And I asked him, well, what happened, John? What happened? And he said, I surrendered. So I wondered, when he first came, he started to talk to me about his enlightenment, and I kind of looked at him, well, wait a minute, buddy. then I became pretty convinced that he really had something there, that he really had an enormous change. He saw God under leaves in everything. And I told Roshi about this. I said, you know, I think this guy's on the level. And I expected that Roshi was going to challenge this pretty strongly. And Roshi simply said he had heard the story, and he said he came to make amends. And that was what signaled to Roshi that it was all genuine. So let's see, where are we with time here? Yeah. That's all I wanted to present for today. I have a very different tack tomorrow. About to talk about some other aspects of Buddhism that we don't normally talk about in our Sangha, but I think it's worth beginning to talk about them, to read about them and talk about them. But right now, so I'd just like to open myself to questions from you. And the more the merrier. I hope there's at least one.
So Wayman, you were doing some work on this place before your Zen practice, before your exposure to Zen practice?
Which place are you talking about?
Pendleton?
Pendle Hill?
Pendle Hill, yeah.
It was about the time of my... I don't want to get too much into a personal story, but I lost a 15-year-old brother to cancer. And my mentor in philosophy in college... was a Quaker, and he suggested I go to Pendle Hill. Actually, I was there at Pendle Hill before I lost my brother, and that was a good place to recover. And if you want my personal history, that's from there I joined a team of the Society of Friends to build and run a rehabilitation center in Vietnam, where I stayed with 4 years and found Ariel. We were married there, and that's a thing, yeah. But Zen was already a part of that. When I went to Pendle Hill, I already knew about Zen through my philosophy teacher, and he knew I was very interested in it. And he had met Edo Tai Shimano, he told me about him, and I found myself very interested. He was a Quaker, but he kind of knew he was losing me. And we studied, I studied Oriental philosophy with him. But yeah, Jared.
I have a question about Prisha. As translated to the word stress sometimes. I feel that it's not uncommon to hear in stories a lot of pressure in Japanese traditions, a lot of stress, a lot of excess sitting, but I'm wondering if for some people maybe less stress is more helpful for them.
I absolutely think that the less stress is, the stress needs to be, I would say the pressure instead of stress, the pressure needs to be adjusted very carefully to each person. And I don't think it always has been. I mean, in the Japanese tradition, there's this kind of, let me call it random toughness. Random. But I don't think in the case of Yasutani's Roshi's dealing with this woman that he definitely applied some pressure, but it was the right amount. And so that's what we actually hope and expect from our teacher, that he will understand where we're at enough, he or she, I mean, whoever is the teacher, will understand intuitively what's good for each person. But, you know, it hasn't always happened that way, and how could it?
Yeah.
I mean, there will be misjudgments and errors, but I am wary that we possibly use too much pressure in some cases, and but most people who stick with it come to. Most people testify that the pressure helped them. Maybe the ones who it didn't help are gone. And that's a worry. That's my feeling about the thing. It needs to be carefully considered and right for each person. It's not going to be the same by any means. But you got a sense of the pressure that Yasutani put on this woman. Not terrible pressure, but definitely keep going. Keep going. It helped her. Yes?
I was going to ask, did the man you referred to as John, the pseudonym?
Right.
Did he end up continuing to sit?
Oh, no, he never sat.
Really? So
yeah, he came out of a incredibly deep depression and was hospitalized. And at some point, he said, I surrendered. I've heard this before from others, too.
So he didn't sit after that at all?
He was not a Zen Buddhist.
Okay.
No, this happened to somebody that was a different faith and happened to come here because he knew Errol and I, and he was going around the country to make amends with people who he felt he had wronged in some way. And so that actually my point of introducing was that it's not always through Zen practice that a deep spiritual experience is possible. But I think it's more advisable to go the Zen route than the be hospitalized for deep depression. Yes.
So in the first set of stories about the athletes, there's
yes.
a sense that you have to kind of give up your attachment to success or aversion to failure. And then in the second story, there's this idea that some pressure is not, how do you feel the pressure without feeling a need to achieve something, right? Like how do you have that pressure without slipping into the trap of needing to, you know, perform up to the pressure?
You find a way. That's a thing. That these people that won found a way to there was the element of self-forgetfulness. They weren't demanding that they win, they were just wanting to do a good make a good effort. And the one young man that won the slope style, he failed on two runs. He was really a talented young guy, And but he said, in the end, he had failed, you know, and he didn't. He says, but I just wanted to make. What he said was, I came all this way, and I didn't want to go away without having a good run. So you see, there wasn't this self-centered grasping anymore. He just wanted to have a good run. He didn't think that he was going to win. Nor did Esther Ledecky think that she was going to win. In fact, she could hardly believe it. She looked at the thing, and she was the winner. And it just, she had no idea that her run was that fast, that excellent. So that's the part that needs to be given up, this grasping. And it's not that you... and resistance to the pressure. You might got to be willing to try, even if you're going to lose. You're going to give it, well, I'm going to give it one more try. But, does that help? Yeah. That was a very good question. That's key. That's what we want to achieve, to work without demanding anything. Yes.
With surrender, I feel like I don't hear much in this tradition.
You don't what? Surrender?
The word surrender, yeah. Is there another word that's maybe...
I think that's when you give up demanding. When you surrender is when you actually accept what has happened, and you are no longer making a strong self-centered demand that it be different. That you that's what each of these winners ultimately they did. They weren't anymore trying in a way that turns out to be negative. So I think surrender means something like that. But I haven't had an experience where I would be able to really talk about my own surrender. I think it's that word is. Some people find that word very that it describes what they experienced. I know another Zen person that describes it that way. I worked. I just stopped thinking about myself. I stopped placing myself at the center of the world. That's what it's all about, actually. I'm no longer demanding that I be important and succeed for myself. I'm trained to succeed, so I try to succeed. But I'm not doing it for a self-centered way. I think that's what turns the pressure off. And
in one of your enlightenment accounts that you read, did I hear you correctly in that the teacher, I think, said to the student, when she passed to move, that she found God or something like that?
That's exactly right. That's exactly what he said. Yeah.
To hear that.
Yes.
Any comments on that? Yes. I'm surprised in the Zen tradition to hear that.
Yes.
Yeah.
But Roshi Kaplow put that in here intentionally. I mean, he didn't cover that up. That's what she said. And let's just put it this way. I've heard others basically say the same thing.
Got it. And let me ask you this. This is a personal question, but obviously with your Quaker background and this, God, I think without really knowing much, I have the impression that God plays a big role in Quakerism. And then do you see this union between Zen Quakerism in terms of
Quakers and Zen Buddhism are very different.
No, but in terms of the Zen practice itself, or Mu, or
Yes, the practice is very different. I mean, for Quakers are much more intellectual.
Or do you find God in your practice? Is that something you personally?
I understand that. I mean, I can say that I've heard that Roshi's used that too. That he doesn't. He knows what's in this book, and he knows that too. That what when you have a deep enlightenment, you've basically seen God. Now, what is God? Well, for one thing, there's a love component. The component that people don't use, the emptiness component and the nothingness component. And Roshi gave a talk by one of the great Zen masters and said, the ultimate enlightenment is when you suddenly say, nothing exists. And that has the component of love in it as well, I think. Yes, Joey.
So it seems like in all these awakening experiences, prior to that, the person is just unwaveringly just totally determined. And I was just wondering, are there any
Totally. What did you? What
was determined.
Oh. No, but they've done total suffering. Don't leave that out. This one was a strong alcoholic. We have people in this sangha. I think you may know that some people were alcoholics before they, and Zen brought them to a release from that scourge. And the thing is that mostly it's suffering, intense suffering, that will bring a person to the point of needing to make an enormous effort. But this success is different for different people. If any kind of samadhi that you are able to get into is a big success in your life already, it's going to change your life. It's going to make you less self-centered. It's going to make you more willing to serve others, to serve all beings. So it's not... I hope that kind of... And Errol's giving me a signal of some sort.
No, I wondered, actually, if there's a difference between this... when we look at the Shi context of effort, and then what about everyday effort...
Everyday effort has to be your own effort. There can't be anybody putting pressure on you. I mean, it's not, you can, what puts pressure on you is your suffering to some extent, don't you think? I mean, so suffering, if you react in the right way to your suffering, it can be helpful. There's lots of people that don't suffer enough and pursue a self-centered existence their whole life. No problem. It's me, me, me all the way.
Raymond, so you said earlier, it sounds like you said grasping. I think you used the term grasping.
Yeah.
And is grasping sort of an attachment to results?
I think it's a lust for results. Yeah.
Do you then, did you bring this up in part because you think that's an impediment for a lot of practitioners?
That is an impediment. That's right. You must give up a lust for results while still working hard to make a change with yourself. But that's... the same, the sports too. The ones that succeeded gave up a lust for winning. They just, the snowboarder, he had given up on it, but he just wanted a good run. The Ledecky, she had pretty much given up. She had no idea how good her run was, So it's just, it's giving up a certain thing. Yeah, I must have it this way. And ultimately, it's giving up. to become to live in service of all beings, that means giving up a lot of me, for sure.
So do you think then that people misunderstand the pressure in Sashim? There's a lot of talk about awakening and so forth, and what would your advice be to people, practically speaking, when
if it's not working for you and you're feeling like you're getting too much pressure and it's not working, then you need to consult seriously with your teacher. And you need to try to get through that it's not working for you, but you really want to be doing this. But you're not sure that it's driving you a little bit in the wrong direction, perhaps, something like that. I mean, but the main thing is not to just hold it in and not talk about it with the teacher. Does that help? Or is that... Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. You talk about the words samadhi and awakening, often replaced by... To be in some kind of samadhi, you say, is of benefit. But then...
Samadhi isn't the same as awakening. Samadhi is the concentration state. And from that, awakening can come. But go ahead. Does that maybe that didn't help with you? What?
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
So then, I think there's more questions you probably can't answer. But like the awakening, are they in another samadhi after that?
Oh yeah, you can have lots of samadhis where there's no awakening. I mean, lots. I don't know. If maybe every sesshin, some level, you're in some level of samadhi, or you're feeling tortured by it. So there's it's just a matter of level. I mean, the quarterback, what's his name again? Nick Foles. I would say he was in a samadhi, but not a samadhi that was going to bring him a deep breakthrough, but it brought him a victory because his performance, not worrying about himself, his performance became nearly perfect. As soon as he had a lot of self-centered thoughts behind his performance, it could never have been as it was.
So there are lots of samadhis. Are
they
different samadhis?
Well, this concentration state is, different in sense of different degrees, different relating to different things, and ours relates to pure meditation. The main point of it is that it's concentration to the point of self-forgetfulness. That's what we're all about. Maybe that's a good arrow's giving me a signal. That's it. Okay. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of the Buddha.